Of course, you can find an ashram in Vermont, or a zendo in Indiana, but there's still nothing quite like heading to India to find your soul. Just ask Elizabeth Gilbert. She's the best-selling author of the book Eat, Pray, Love, which chronicles, among other things, her months of meditation and spiritual blood, sweat, and tears in an Indian ashram. She says it was an early midlife crisis, including a messy divorce, that brought her to India to follow in the footsteps of generations of spiritual seekers from the West.
The Greeks and the Romans wrote about sending people to India to find holy men and coming back with ideas from there. For some reason, India has always been this epicenter of scholarly devotional practice. And I feel like I was just another in a, you know, couple thousands of years tradition of people taking pilgrimages to that place.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also had an Indian guru, and you had spent some time with her and meditating before you went over to India. And I guess I'm wondering if you had thought about yourself, say, 10 years ago, could you have ever guessed that that you would have an Indian guru?
I'm sorry to laugh. No. I'm trying to think of a more clever way to answer that question, but quite simply, no. The Indian guru who I, you know, worked with on this journey, and when I say that, I say that very indirectly. This is still a person who I've never met face-to-face, although I was her student during those years, mostly through hearing her speak or reading her books or, you know, following practices that she had suggested.
Even that word, guru, I mean, that has a lot of baggage in this country, really, ever since the 60s. I mean, we've certainly heard all the stories of gurus who may not have turned out to be charlatans, but, you know, they had sometimes shady motivations as well. But you're very upfront about using that word, guru.
Yeah, I decided, you know, call it what it is. But the word, well, it has shady implications here. It has a really rich heritage in India. It means in Sanskrit, the words literally translate as guru, which is darkness, and ru, which is light. And the idea is that this is a teacher who will help you move yourself out of darkness and into light. The first I heard through a friend of mine, the first I saw her photograph and said, who is that, you know, stunningly beautiful, serene-looking Indian woman? And he said, that's my spiritual teacher. And it really was a kind of heart reaction, which is, again, not necessarily something I experience all the time as a very heady person, you know. I'm very driven by intellect and thoughts and words. And it was just this kind of cascading, you know, this sensation of my heart just opening up and something from deep inside my chest saying, I want a spiritual teacher so much. And so I sort of jumped into it.
So here you were, this New York woman. Your life was in a bit of a shambles at this point, and you go off to India. You start settling into an ashram. What was it like there once you got there?
It was reassuringly sane. I would say that was one of the things that I most enjoyed about the experience was that there was very little trace of sort of patchouli-scented nonsense, which as somebody who had just recently lived in Hell's Kitchen, I'm not sure that I could have really taken. You know, one thing that I think is funny was that I went to India with this very predetermined sense of what my teachers in India would look like. They were certainly going to be Indian, you know, and they were going to be real exotic kind of National Geographic looking gurus in orange robes, you know, with ash on their foreheads. And instead, what I discovered at the ashram was that the most compelling teacher that I met was this guy named Richard from Texas, who was a recovered alcoholic / drug user / dealer, Vietnam vet, truck driver from Austin, who was also on this spiritual journey and had been for many years and was there at the ashram and somehow kind of like fell into my path and managed to take all these really esoteric, ancient Sanskrit, yogic, Hindu ideas and translate them for me down to this vernacular of Texas reduction that was so perfect that, you know, like just hit me in a way that I really needed to be reached, you know?
Well, you talk about how rigorous this was. I mean, this wasn't just sort of going off and, you know, listening to nice Indian music. I mean, you had to get up in the middle of the night, you know, before the crack of dawn to start meditating. And meditating is hard work when you do it seriously.
It is. I mean, it wasn't a spa, you know, it wasn't a vacation. It was, you know, it's a monastery. And so it keeps those kind of hours that religious traditions all over the world keep, you know, when you start getting really serious about the soul, which meant getting up at 3:30 every morning, you know. And, you know, I mean, we would have, I'm going to say 4 or 5 hours of rigorous spiritual practice before breakfast. It was hard. It was physically hard, emotionally hard, spiritually hard. And for somebody who, you know, even at that point, after, you know, a couple years of meditation practice and yoga practice, I was still somebody who could not, at that point that I arrived at the ashram, spend 5 minutes alone in her own company in silence without wanting to crawl out of her skin. You know, and so to go from really being unable to tolerate my own presence on earth, which is really what it felt like when I sat in meditation, and I think many people beginning meditation practices feel that way. You know, you start off kind of with high expectations, and then very quickly you become bored, agitated, and full of self-loathing.
So how did you get there? Was it just a matter of time, of toughing it out, of crying when you felt like, you know, you weren't getting it right, and then, you know, somehow getting through to the other side? Or was there a particular breakthrough moment?
There were numbers of little breakthroughs. I mean, a lot of it was about doing it, working on it, and then talking about it with other people who had been doing it for a longer period of time. That's one of the nice things about going into an ashram, is that you're not alone. And I remember once, you know, going in, you know, almost hysterics. I went up to this monk and I just said, I'm so frustrated and angry, and it was 115 degrees out, and it was just, you know, I just thought, what am I doing here? I'm ruining this whole opportunity. And he said, you know, just go sit in the meditation cave, which is what they call it because it's sort of underground and cool. He said, just go sit in there and don't worry about meditating. Just sit, and at the very least, you'll cool off. You know? And I thought that was such a generous thing for a religious scholar to say. Like, at the very least, you know, you won't have to sit in this 115-degree sun. And he meant it temperamentally, too. At the very least, you'll settle down a little bit. I wish I could say that there was kind of one radical breakthrough, but I think it's like anything else that you do, you know. And by the time I left the ashram, I could sit in meditation without wanting to assassinate myself for 4 or 5 hours at a stretch. And I would say that's a tremendous transformation in a person's life, to be able to tolerate their own presence on the planet. It's a pretty good start for being able to tolerate, you know, other people, for instance.
Now, was this meditation practice part of what we would call yoga?
Yeah, I mean, yoga in the traditional Indian sense, I mean, here in the West, we've come to sort of narrowly define yoga as, you know, exercise, stretching, classes that you go to.
Being able to twist yourself into a pretzel.
Being able to put your ankle over your ear, you know, that kind of thing. And that's just one limb of what is traditionally in Hindu theology called yoga. Yoga is a word that translates in Sanskrit as union. It comes from the root of the word yoke, you know, the idea that you are yoking yourself to the divine, you know, that you are attaching yourself. And I like the fact that it's yoked like an oxen, which indicates already the work that's involved. You know, it's not a tether. it's not a feathery little connection. You're yoked, you know, which means plowing and pulling and working.
So if really the goal of yoga is this yoking with the divine, this union with God, how close did you get to God?
Well, you know, the Buddha always said, they tell me, that one must not become addicted to peak experiences along the path of meditation, which was a statement that used to frustrate me because I was like, I would love to have a peak experience to get addicted to. You know, where's my peak experience? I'm not getting that drugged feeling that, you know, other people are talking about. I did have, toward the end of my stay, one of these, you know, something that you could only really describe as an experience of full momentary transcendence that occurred during a very routine session of meditation where, for reasons that I still can't really identify today, though, I suspect that the fact that I had been doing this every day for 3.5 months probably had something to do with it. What they call the veils of illusion, you know, fell from my eyes. And as I sat there, I suddenly, you know, the only way I can say it is I completely understood the workings of the universe. And I didn't just know intellectually that I was part of this divine mystery. I knew it with every cell of my being that I was an intricate and beloved part of a very mysterious and wonderful love, and that I was connected by that love to everybody and everything. And the sense that I had of it was it wasn't sort of dazzling, you know, it wasn't sparkly lights and you know, crazy visions. It was the most serene I have ever felt. And in my reading, the only thing that I can see that approaches it is the way people talk about near-death experiences, you know, when they see that sort of peaceful light and they just feel like it's all so taken care of, you know, there's really nothing to be alarmed at. It's really, there is a plan here and you can relax into it completely. And it seemed sort of amusing to me that I ever would have worried about anything, you know, or that people would ever have any disputes with one another. It just all seemed sort of comic. Like, why, with a love so great, as the poet Hafiz said, are we all not screaming drunks?
Elizabeth Gilbert is the best-selling author of Eat, Pray, Love. She lives, writes, and meditates in New Jersey. She talked to Steve Paulson.